I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There were funerals yesterday in Yemen for dozens of children who were killed in an airstrike last week. Pictures of their mangled bodies and their school bus are shocking and deeply disturbing, considered one of the deadliest attacks on civilians in the war that is ground on since 2015. There's video of the children having fun and enjoying their field trip moments before they were killed. Dozens more children were wounded in the Saudi-led coalition attack, which it called a legitimate military operation. The United States, which has been supporting the coalition, called for a thorough and transparent investigation. Defense Secretary Mattis sent a three-star general to Riyadh to look into what happened. Well, we wanted to know what happened as well, and we asked Nasser Arabi to join us. He's a freelance journalist based in Sana'a in Yemen, joining us by Skype. Nasser Arabi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your interest in Yemen.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome on that. Let me get our other two guests in on the conversation. Shireen Al-Adimi is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She's played an active role in raising awareness about U.S.-supported Saudi-led war in her country of birth, Yemen. Shireen Al-Adimi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Lee Keith is with us. He's a reporter for the Associated Press. Based in Cairo, has been covering Yemen. And Lee Keith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Let me just read something. This was one of the first medics on the scene, a man named Hussein Tayeb, and he told the Houthi TV network, and I'm quoting here, "As soon as I arrived with the others wanting to help out, we figured we had to quickly nurse the wounded because there was chaos. People were running over bodies and shouting. As I was nursing people, I lifted a body and found that it was Ahmed's face. I carried him and hugged him. He was my son." Heartbreaking. Nasser, can you describe the scene for us?
Thank you very much. Well, this is very heartbreaking for anyone. This father did not lose only one son. He lost three sons. Ahmed is one. So Yusuf, 14. Ahmed, 11. And Ali, 9. Hmm. So three. He lost three sons, and he found the dead bodies of only two. And when he came back to the house, his wife was crying and screaming, "Where is Ali? Where is Ali? Where is Ali?" And he said, I didn't find him. And then they later found him in the hospital at the end of the day. It's very heartbreaking. This is just a very small example of what U.S. Saudi war criminals are doing for 4 years now. This massacre is only one of the U.S. Saudi war criminals for 4 years in Yemen. Not only one. So this is, I'm very highly grateful for you to start with this story, in particular of Zayd Hussein Tayyib. Because it might give a good example of what is happening in Yemen. Whole families are being killed by U.S. Saudi war criminals for 4 years now in Yemen.
Shireen, let me get you in on the conversation here. It's as we're talking about Yemen, I'm looking at my TV and it's all Omarosa all the time. Is this a forgotten war?
Well, it's not forgotten. It's certainly ignored, and it's deliberately ignored, it seems like, because the information is there. Like Nasser has said, this is ongoing now. This is the fourth year, and there is no shortage of dead bodies in Yemen, of dead children in Yemen. 113,000 children starved to death in 2016 and 2017 because of the Saudi-led blockade and because of diseases like cholera. And we have children who've now, 50 children on this bus, 40 of whom were killed. And other massacres on a daily basis. Just today, there was a family that was attacked and they were killed. And so the information is out there, but why the U.S. press is not reporting on it and reporting on it consistently and given our involvement in the war is really perplexing. This is not a civil war anymore. This was a civil war. Saudi Arabia got involved in the civil war, turning it into an international intervention. And the United States is part of the coalition that is causing all of these airstrikes and the hunger and the starvation in Yemen. So why the U.S. press is not reporting on it as, to inform what you know, taxpayers what is happening in our name in Yemen is really perplexing.
Well, let me get Lee Keith, in on the conversation. He has been covering this war for the Associated Press. What is it like, Lee, for you to report on Yemen?
It's a very difficult environment. We have a reporter in Sana'a who reports from there. Our lead reporter on a lot of our work has been Maggie Michael, a Cairo-based reporter who's gone to Yemen multiple times. It's an extremely difficult environment. She travels around the south. She has done one or two trips to the north territory controlled by the Houthis, as well as across the south, where the coalition-led forces are in control. But it's an extremely complex environment.
Let me go back to you, Nasser. And you posted on Twitter a picture of, I don't know if it's a missile or a bomb. Nonetheless, you identified it as part of this strike last week. And it clearly has English writing letters on it. What does it say?
Well, it says that it's a guided bomb, U.S.-made guided bomb, and it's now known where it is made in the United States. It's very clear, and it is not the first time to find such remnants or such fragments of U.S.-made bombs. It's been found in dozens or in hundreds of attacks like this. So it was very, very natural to Yemenis to see such remnants and of U.S.-made bombs, because we know that most of the Saudi weapons, if not all, are U.S.-made weapons.
I'm quoting here from U.S. Central Command spokesman Major Josh Jack. He told Vox, quote, "We may never know if the munition used was one the U.S. sold to Saudi Arabia. We don't have a lot of people on the ground." Shireen, what's your response to that?
Well, we know that there have been $115 billion in, sold in weapons under the Obama administration, and then $350 billion in weapons sold under the Trump administration. So it's no secret that this relationship we have with Saudi Arabia is largely based on these contracts. The Central Command has said that they were involved in helping with the mid-air refueling, so Saudi Arabia as they're in the UAE as they're bombing in Yemen. The U.S. Navy provides mid-air refueling for them. The U.S. Army has boasted about all the contracts that they have in Saudi Arabia with, you know, training Saudi personnel and updating and maintaining their vehicles. And so for U.S. weapons to end up in Yemen and to be used toward this war is no surprise. The Saudis do not manufacture their own weapons. They import most of their weapons from the United States, as well as the U.K. and Canada and various European countries, some of whom have stopped selling weapons to Saudi Arabia in light of the apparent war crimes that have been going on in Yemen. But, you know, we can't dissociate ourselves from this war in Yemen when we're so heavily involved in it. We can't say, well, we didn't know about it, we don't really know where our weapons are going, when we know that this is an ongoing war, that the Saudis are using these weapons to wage war in Yemen.
Well, help our listeners understand, this is a civil war that is, sounds like it's more now a proxy war, like a number of wars in the Middle East. How did the United States get involved?
The United States,
I'm just going to put that to Lee. Go ahead, Lee.
Sorry.
That's all right.
The U.S. got involved when Saudi Arabia and its allies dove in, when the rebels known as Houthis took over in the north and started moving towards the south. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are the chief ones in the coalition, began their bombing campaign. They clamped down with the blockade around the country, and the U.S. joined in behind them. They sort of fell in step, and they've been intimately involved since, where they've had advisors in Riyadh helping out in the command center. But the Saudi and the U.S. professed goal has been to what they see as to thwart what they consider an Iranian-backed attempt to take over the country. And so this sort of broader sort of move to push back Iran around the region has really taken over the viewpoint of the entire viewpoint of the conflict, where other considerations like Yemen's stability and all the destruction that's being wreaked there has become a secondary consideration.
So Yemen is caught in this middle between what, Sunni Shia conflict, Lee?
I think the sectarian Sunni Shiite part is not the main issue. I think it's more of a geopolitical conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I think that sometimes gets expressed in these sectarian terms, but I wouldn't say that that's the heart of it. I think it's more of a geopolitical situation, a rivalry.
Shireen, how do you see it?
I don't see Iran as being involved in Yemen. It's been 3.5 years. We don't have any credible evidence of Iranian weapons in Yemen. Like Lee said, there's a blockade, land, sea, and air blockade, but somehow we're led to believe that Iranians are able to smuggle weapons into Yemen. This is, of course, what the Saudis are claiming they're doing in Yemen, because it doesn't make sense to otherwise say, you know, justify why they're in Yemen. But historically, Saudi Arabia has been involved in Yemen's politics in the 30s, in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 90s even. Anytime there was a civil war, anytime there was civil conflict in Yemen, Saudi Arabia chose a side and was actively involved in, you know, choosing whichever side they wanted to win. And so this isn't new for Yemenis. This just represents the most extreme form of Saudi domination in Yemen.
Now, sir, about a minute or so before a break that we have coming up, describe what it's like. You live in Sana'a, you're based in Sana'a in Yemen. What is it like to live in Yemen?
Well, now, you know, it's 4 years now. We are under such aggression and blockade. It's very difficult, of course, to, you know, to describe that situation that everyone now knows as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. But, you know, Yemenis are determined to face their destiny, their fate, and until the end, because it's a wrongdoing being done on them, and it's Saudi Arabia influence and expansionism that wants to take the land and the wealth of Yemen under fake justifications like Iran and other things. Saudi Arabia wants something different from what is being said and what it says to the world. So Yemenis are, you know, they are, the more the or the longer the aggression, the more determined the people to defend themselves. This is what I can say about this.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Nasser Arabi, freelance journalist based in Sana'a in Yemen. We will carry on our conversation with our other two guests. Lee Keith, he's a reporter for the Associated Press based in Cairo, has been covering Yemen along with other reporters for the Associated Press. And Shireen Al-Adimi, assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She was born in Yemen. You can join us 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org, at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the war in Yemen and also the humanitarian crisis there as well with Shireen Al-Adimi and also with Lee Keith. Shireen, let me go to you, and I read a little bit about you. You grew up in Yemen. In fact, lived through two civil wars while living in Yemen. And our guest Nasser Arabi described the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. I was reading something like 20 million people are in some degree of crisis, not having access to food and water and shelter. How do Yemenis survive under these conditions?
Well, they're barely surviving. It's a population of 27 million, so 80% of the population is in need of some kind of humanitarian aid. Many people who have family abroad are relying on those family members to help them through these difficult situations. You know, and it crosses all sorts of economic strata. People who have been wealthy are affected, and of course, you can't imagine people who are already struggling before the war. People have lost their jobs. Anyone working for government hasn't been receiving salaries for the last 2.5 years. And, you know, prices are extremely expensive, and whatever food trickles into the country is difficult to afford for many families. And so when the UN calls this the world's worst humanitarian crisis, it really isn't an exaggeration. People are barely surviving, and many people are not surviving. We've had, I think I mentioned earlier, 113,000 children in 2016 and 2017 died of preventable illnesses and malnutrition. And by the end of this year, perhaps 18 more million people are going to starve to death. And so this is a crisis as worse, as bad as it can get.
Do you have family, friends, relatives in Yemen?
Yeah. Yes, relatives all over the country and close friends, and they're struggling to survive.
Lee Keith, let me go back to you. And I'm looking at an article that you co-wrote with Maggie Michael and Trish Wilson. This has to do with the United States and also Saudi Arabia fighting al-Qaeda militants in Yemen. And yet what you found was that while there have been victories on the battlefield, in certain ways, the deals have been to pay al-Qaeda fighters to essentially leave some of these cities. Help us understand what you found.
What we found is that the coalition claimed a number of victories of having driven al-Qaeda out of towns that it controlled in the south. What we found was that instead, often they struck deals beforehand to have the al-Qaeda militants just leave the cities, taking with them their weapons and whatever money they had looted along the way. In some cases, they even paid the militants to leave. And so you had these giant convoys of militants leaving these areas, and then several days later, the Emirati-backed forces would move into these towns and claim victory. But it's part of, in general, the sort of strange alignments that have been taking place in here, where Al Qaeda is fighting the Houthis as well, and so it's created. Oftentimes it's fighting alongside coalition-backed forces or in forces that in some of these armed militias that are backed by the coalition. They'll recruit from Al Qaeda fighters to join them. At the same time, Al Qaeda is recruiting from the front lines. When you have all these different forces all together against the Houthis in some of these battle zones, the Al Qaeda militants can recruit from the other factions on the ground as well. So it's this strange symbiotic relationship that's come to develop.
I mean, it's a proxy war on steroids, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the number of dimensions that this is just spiraled into this horrible situation on multiple levels.
Shireen, what do you want the U.S. to do? When you wrote a story about some members of Congress that have invoked the War Powers Resolution to address U.S. involvement in Yemen and support of coalition forces, what do you want the United States to do?
Well, I think what Yemenis want is for the United States to not be involved in this war on their country, for Saudi Arabia to not be involved, and the only way people see a way out of this war, at least not the civil war part of this, but the international attack on their country, is if the United States stops supporting the Saudi-led coalition militarily. So twice now Congress has invoked the War Powers Resolution. They've passed a bill acknowledging that the U.S. is at war in Yemen without congressional approval. And to that end, we need to continue to try to pass bills that would end U.S. involvement in Yemen, end mid-air refueling, the selling of weapons, the assistance with targeting. We also know now that there are U.S. special forces on the ground at the Yemen-Saudi Arabia border. And all of this is done without congressional approval, and this is what's fueling the war in Yemen. So if we want this war to end, then our best hope is really through U.S. lawmakers.
And why is mid-air refueling, why is that important?
So the Saudi Arabians, I mean, they don't make their own weapons. They also don't train their own soldiers. They rely on the U.S. to do that. But they also don't refuel their own planes mid-air. They can't stop in the country to refuel and go back up. So the United States Army provides that mid-air refueling, which is a huge part of this war. Saudi Arabia doesn't have, there are no Saudi Arabian soldiers on the ground. They hire local forces in Al-Qaeda and so on. But they've been waging this war from the air, and the United States is helping them do that more effectively.
And Lee, this involves both the Obama administration and also the Trump administration. Has the Trump administration upped the ante when it comes to this coalition, Saudi-led coalition that is essentially waging a war in Yemen?
they've certainly dropped whatever reservations that the Obama administration showed. At one point during the Obama administration, they pulled advisors out of Riyadh for a period. Those have since returned. There's been much far fewer reservations. Not that the reservations under the Obama administration were particularly great, but whatever did exist have been reversed. They've also increased drone strikes targeting Al Qaeda, although the effectiveness of those is not very clear. There were some significant leaders of Al Qaeda killed by drone strikes during the Obama administration. There have been a lot more strikes in the first year of the Trump administration, but fewer leadership figures killed, probably because they're taking greater precautions. But as far as the alliance with the coalition in the war, there's been no sign of any sort of reservation on that.
Do we know how much influence the United States has over Saudi Arabia? Mattis has sent a 3-star general to investigate. There are calls for the Saudi government to investigate what happened that led to all these children being killed. Do we know, Lee, does the U.S. have influence and are they willing to use it?
Well, I mean, there hasn't been much of a sign in the past of it. This is hardly the first, as horrible as this strike against the children was, it's hardly the first one that's caused significant civilian casualties. And in the past, there's been calls for investigations before, and we don't see very much out of it. Certainly, the U.S. has considerable leverage with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. The arms deals being a huge part of that leverage. But there's little sign that they've been ready to use that sort of leverage. They've sort of fallen. The U.S. administration has tended to fall behind the coalition line of depicting this conflict as part of this anti-Iranian conflict.
Shireen, let me quote something that CNN reported. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke Monday with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, but according to a State Department readout of the conversation, the top U.S. diplomat made no mention of last week's Saudi-led airstrike. What does that tell you?
Well, as difficult as this may be for American listeners citizens, the U.S. is part of this coalition. Why should they talk about something when the U.S. has already helped them with these strikes? They provide the fuel, they provide the weapons, they provide the training. There's this pretense that we're going to discipline the Saudi Arabians for this latest war crime, but really we're partners in this coalition. Every airstrike that happens in Yemen is with the help of the United States. Senator Chris Murphy says there's an American imprint on every civilian death in Yemen. And so, you know, we can't pretend to not be part of the coalition when it serves us best. And it's not surprising that they wouldn't discuss this given how involved the U.S. has been in the Saudi-led coalition's attack on Yemen.
Shireen, what do you and other Yemenis and people that care about Yemen, what do you want?
We don't want foreign intervention. I mean, this war wouldn't have gotten to this degree if there was any foreign intervention in Yemen. And again, like I said, the best hope for this war to end is for the U.S. to stop helping the Saudi Arabians destroy Yemen and kill its citizens with impunity. And so if the U.S. Pulls out of the war tomorrow, yes, we'll continue to have a civil war. This might drag on for a while, but it could never get as bad as it is right now with 80% of the population suffering, trying to, you know, sustain themselves. There's no food, there's no water, there's no jobs. Hospitals have been bombed. The country is blockaded. And so it's only as bad as it is today because of this foreign intervention. So we hope that we see an end to foreign intervention in Yemen.
Lee, how do you see this ending, or can you?
For the time being, I don't see it. It looks like it's going to continue to drag on like this. There's been considerable fighting. The fighting has focused right now on the port of Hodeidah, which endangers things even more because that's the main port for the entrance of humanitarian aid into the country. The coalition forces have been fighting for weeks trying to take it. It's a heavy battle. There was there were strikes in the market there that killed dozens of people as well during this fighting. So it's just an ugly situation there.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Lee Keith, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for the Associated Press based in Cairo. Shireen Al-Adhemi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She plays an active role in raising awareness about U.S.-supported Saudi-led war on her country of birth, Yemen. Well, there's another war in the Middle East involving the United States that has dragged on for 7 years in Syria. What began as a civil war has morphed into a proxy war involving, besides the United States, Russia, Turkey, the Kurds, Iran, ISIS. Millions of Syrians have been displaced. Untold numbers of civilians have been killed. And pictures of devastation in parts of the country are really shocking. There are reports, though, that the war could be coming to an end as the Syrian government troops target rebel held areas. If that's true, what happens next? It's hard to imagine the country being put back together again. Joshua Landis joins us. He's an associate professor and director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, also the president of the Syrian Studies Association. Joshua Landis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A number of reports in the last couple of days, including one from the Washington Post, basically saying it looks like the war could be winding down. Also that it could be entering a very dangerous part of the war. How do you see what's happening in Syria today?
Well, there is a big standoff. The government has been rapidly retaking territory from the rebels, who've been collapsing fairly quickly. In the south of Syria, Daraa province, that's by Israel, the Golan Heights, and Jordan, just collapsed last month. 56 rebel groups either had to reconcile with the government, which means that they go over and serve with government troops and go back to civilian life, or flee the country, or go up north. And some of them chose to go up north to a province called Idlib. And this has become the big collection point now for the remaining rebel fighters. And Idlib province, which is up next to Turkey, has about 2 to 3 million people in it, many refugees. But of those people are tons of fighters, well over 100,000 rebel fighters that have chosen to leave other parts of Syria or have been in that province to begin with. About 60% of Idlib province is controlled by a group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS for short, which is the al-Qaeda-affiliated group. It's designated as a terrorist organization by the United States. Mm. And this makes it a very complicated region, full of different militias, some of whom have been fighting each other intensely. Turkey has protected this province. It's got 12 observation points that have tanks in them and cement protections and so forth. So Erdogan and Ankara have said that they will not let Syria retake this province. Syria, on the other hand, has been amassing its troops, moving everybody from the south, where the last offensive was, up to the north, and it says that it's going to retake Idlib, you know, imminently. So there's everybody's bristling. And it really is up to Russia what's going to happen, because Turkey would make short work of Syrian army and Syrian air force. But Russia is an ally of Syria. It controls the air. Russia is also an ally of Ankara. So everybody, all eyes are now looking to see what will Russia do? Will it restrain Syria? And there's a meeting going on presently between Lavrov, the foreign minister, and the Turkish foreign minister. And everybody is watching. There are 2 million plus civilians in this region. It's very poor. Assad would like to drive all of those rebels into Turkey, scatter them across Anatolia. They've been supported by the West and Turkey and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, for the last 7 years. He sees them as people who want to destroy the state, and he wants to push them out of the country. Turkey does not want more refugees.
Well, it's interesting you describing this situation between Turkey, the Assad government, the role of Russia. Where is the United States? And I know the United States has been allied with the Kurds in Syria, but does the U.S. have any role in this upcoming fight?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Of course, the United States helped many of the militias that are now corralled in Idlib province and had vetted them, given them arms, paid their salaries, so forth. So it is but the United States, McGurk, who is the head of the anti-ISIS coalition, the political head of the anti-ISIS coalition in Syria, said some months ago that Idlib is the largest collecting point of al-Qaeda members since 9/11. So the United States is at sixes and sevens over what to do. On the one hand, they want those al-Qaeda people who might threaten the West destroyed. Mm-hmm. On the other, they don't want Assad to regain more power. They want to keep him weak. And they support, theoretically, Turkey through NATO. But Turkey has been trying to get America to side with them on this issue, and America is not doing it. And America, as we know, is in terrible relations with Turkey that have been just recently. We put sanctions on Turkey. We've refused to sell them deliver F-15s that they're supposed to get. So our relations, the U.S. relations with Turkey, are in a free fall right now. So Turkey is really quite isolated, and that's the situation. So it's a bad situation for those rebels, many of whom look to America and feel abandoned, and for Turkey.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Syria, and our guest is Joshua Landis from the University of Oklahoma, and he has been covering and writing about and opining about Syria for many years now. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and expert on Syria, also director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the university, joining us from their studios. And again, you can join us as well. This is a part of the world that is complicated. The U.S. is involved, and it's important to know what's going on. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Joshua, you mentioned Russia. They came sort of later to the game, I would say, certainly after the United States. Is the future of Syria in Russia's hands, and what does Russia want?
It is in Russia's hands. At least that's the way it seems today. Now, of course, the United States, it should be said, still has a presence and dominates 30% of Syrian territory through its alliance with what's called the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are not very democratic, but they're dominated by the Kurds, about 10% of the Syrian population, 10 to 12%, who live mostly in the north. And they partnered with the United States to destroy ISIS and did a really tremendous job. So the United States still has over 2,000 special forces and other government officials up in the north and is helping the Kurds. But President Trump has said that he wants to leave Syria. So the Kurds are looking to the Syrian government today and trying to patch up their relations in expectation that the United States will eventually withdraw from northern Syria. So the United States has a big role, and but it's unclear what they're going to do to stop Russia from becoming the dominant player. And Russia has been, it must be said, been the main ally of Syria since the 1950s. So this is not a big change. America was hoping that it could throw out Iran and Russia and bring Syria into the orbit of Saudi Arabia, America, Israel. But that didn't happen. And so the U.S. has really got to scratch its head today and decide what its profile should be in the northern Middle East, because Russia and Iran are the dominant players, both in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. really this long stretch over the northern Middle East.
Which raises the question, certainly the U.S. war in Iraq helped to destabilize the region, but the United States has also been blamed for the crisis, or at least in part the crisis in Syria today, for its inaction. So on the one hand, you've got action, you've got inaction. What options does the United States have?
Well, today the options are very...
You all right
the
there?
Options are not... Yeah, I'm fine. I just banged into the back of the... The options are few for the United States. Really, as you said in your intro, by going into Iraq in 2003 and overthrowing a Sunni Arab government dominated by Saddam Hussein that was inimical to Iran and catapulting the Shiites, who were at the bottom of Iranian society, to the top and putting them in government and in rule, and the army today is dominated by Shiites in Iraq. It's not quite so simple, but they are allied today with Iran, and they helped Assad remain in power and are allied with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So the U.S. is largely responsible for the shift, this sort of pro-Iranian shift over the northern Middle East, and the U.S. has tried to reverse that a little bit by helping Sunni rebels overthrow a pro-Iranian government in Syria, but they failed. And so the United States is really scratching its head, and it would make sense for the United States to be getting closer to Turkey and building up relations with Turkey, but that's not happening because Erdogan has become more dictatorial, more Islamist, and the United States chose the Kurds instead of the Turks. Hmm. And this has really alienated Turkey, whose population is made up of roughly 20%, maybe more, Kurds. And they're worried that America's support for Syria's Kurds will bleed into Turkey, reanimate a Kurdish anti-Turkish insurgency in eastern Anatolia, and could lead to the breakup of Turkey. So Erdogan is furious at America and has caused relations to really decline. So the United States doesn't have a real toehold in this northern Middle East. It's got a few with the Kurds, but it looks like the United States doesn't have a real policy to return.
Let me read a couple of comments. An email from Brendan. He emailed us a little while ago. U.S. foreign policy is once again complicit in war crimes and the death of innocent civilians. And for what? Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and next Iran have all been strategic failures, haven't made the world safer, and have cost us trillions of dollars. When will people/voters start paying attention? A comment from Kate. The mess that the entire world is in is due to wars. The mess we made in Afghanistan and Iraq had huge repercussions all over. Until wars are made legal, there won't be any change. Joshua, I'm just curious then, do you see the Assad, although you said Turkey's pretty strong forces in this part of Syria that's going to be fought over, do you see the Assad government military forces, see them winning? Or what do you anticipate if this really gets to a serious conflict?
It all depends on Russia, once again, because Turkey's not going to want to go to war against Russia if Russia backs up Assad. And so far it has. And that's the same calculation that Obama made in 2015 when Russia jumped in on the side of the Syrians and sent its air force to help Assad. Obama the next day said the United States is not going to go to war against Russia for Syria. And that's really the calculation that Turkey has to make. Does it want to go to war against Russia for Syria? Or it has to convince Russia to side against Assad with Turkey. And Russia's been helping Assad for the last 2 years. Russia's not going to move against. Now, they're trying to negotiate some smooth landing for Idlib, but it doesn't look like there is a smooth landing. It defies an easy political solution because Syria wants to drive all of those rebels out of Syria, and Turkey doesn't want them. So we've got a real sort of nail-biter here.
Well, it raises a number of questions, which is if someone, quote-unquote, wins this war, what have they won? And I mentioned in my introduction, and I think anyone that has seen, you know, pictures of certain parts of Syria, just completely devastated cities and neighborhoods, what have you won if you win this war?
Well, that's true. It is a completely, not completely. the parts that have been fought over, which are a lot of Syria, are very devastated. And it's a country that will have to pick itself up by its bootstraps, not unlike the United States after its civil war, that at least the South, which was very devastated, but did rebuild. And or Japan after World War II, where America, in just 4 days of bombing in Tokyo, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, killed almost as many people have been killed in the entire Syrian civil war. Japan, 60-something cities in Japan were bombed and burnt badly. So nations do rebuild. Of course, Syria is a very poor nation. It's going to be difficult. They have to look to the east, to China, Russia, other neighboring countries to help them rebuild, because the United States has said that it will not help reconstruct. The West has also said not. The Congress has passed a bill saying that nobody can help Syria reconstruct. So the West is really out of the picture. They don't like Assad. They see him as a butcher who should not be helped. And that means that China and Russia and so forth will be looked to help Syria and local merchants.
And local merchants?
Yes. I mean, most of this money is probably just going to come from local Syrians.
Really? To rebuild an entire country? You know, go ahead.
Well, you know, I just sent about some money to a friend of mine who lives in Deir ez-Zor, which is a city on the Euphrates, way up in the northeast of Syria. He just returned to his home in a city which is 80% leveled.
Wow.
His building was completely stripped. All of the aluminum window frames torn out. The cement walls were drilled into so the wires could be fished out of them. You know, every appurtenance in the entire apartment building was ripped out. So he's got to rebuild. And he sent me a sort of an SOS and said, anything you can do. And so people are pitching in. You know, it's impossible to send money to Syria. I have to send it to Lebanon. And then he has to make a handoff to a cousin who's going to drive into Syria. It's because of sanctions. It's very hard to help anybody in Syria because America doesn't, you know, wants to hurt Assad and the Syrian regime. But people are beginning to rebuild, and they have to take care of their families. So any way they can, they're beginning to, you know, throw cement back on walls and buy things and rebuild.
You mentioned the fact that, looking into your crystal ball there, that the future involves Russia and China making some investments, I guess, or maybe even a Marshall Plan or their version of a Marshall Plan in Syria. Does that mean the United States loses a sphere of influence, and is that a good thing?
Well, Syria was never a U.S. sphere of influence. Right. We've been enemies with Syria since 1948, really, since the war when Syria declared war against the emerging state of Israel. And very soon after, Syria went to the Soviet sphere in order to get arms. And it's been – America and Syria have been at loggerheads ever since. So we're not losing anything. We didn't gain anything. We really so in that sense, this is not a travesty for the United States.
Really?
The U.S. has never had many interests in Syria. But – it's, you know, the U.S. today sees Iran as its major enemy, and I guess emerging Russia as a major enemy. It's not clear how we see that. And so having those two countries have a sphere of influence in their neighborhood is, of course, something America doesn't like. And America's allies, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Israel, don't like it either. So that's... But how much it hurts America, not really clear. It's not good for maintaining our relationship and our credibility in the region with our allies, but it doesn't really hurt the United States. And in some ways, the return of an Assad government will help policing Syria, which will keep ISIS out. So in that sense, you could say there are some benefits for the United States in terms of counterterrorism.
Is that the main worry then, to... if not defeat ISIS, reduce its staying power?
It is. It is a main worry. But the United States is torn between the counterterrorism and pushing Iran and Russia out. Those are the two agendas. And you hear government officials express both of them. And in many ways, they're at counter purposes because – Iran, being a pro-Shiite power, pro-Assad, is against ISIS, which is Sunni.
Right.
And the Russia is also against Sunni rebels and jihadists. And in Idlib, there are about several thousand Chechens and other rebels which want to go back to Russia and fight against the regime. So Russia is very interested in having the Syrian regime reassert its control over Idlib province because it wants those people dead. And so in a sense, you could say that this is if, you know, the Assad regime is good for counterterrorism, but it's bad for the United States because the United States is sided with Assad's enemies. So it's a, you know, America doesn't want a strong Assad.
Is this a sort of a strange version of a Cold War in that if the real war in the Middle East is between Shia and Sunni, then depending on which side you're on, begins to sound a lot like the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States?
Well, it is. There are elements of that, but it really it's about nation building in the Middle East and who, you know, what is the identity of each of these countries? I have, in many ways, I would compare what's going on in the Levant, in the Middle East today, to what happened in Central Europe between the wars, World War I and World War II. In World War I, all of these nation states, whether it's in Central Europe or in the Middle East, were created out of big multi-ethnic empires. Borders were drawn willy-nilly by people in Paris Peace Conference 1919, around different ethnic groups, different religious groups, and stuck them in one nation and said, you've got to have a common political identity. And then in almost every state, from Poland to Palestine, failed spectacularly. Mm. In Central Europe, it was during World War II that tremendous bloodletting, and each ethnic group cleansed the others. So the Poles today is 100% Polish, but it was only 64% Polish before World War II because the Jews were killed, 3 million Jews, 5 million Germans were wiped out, Ukrainians were pushed out. The same thing happened to Czechoslovakia, Hungary, right down the line. And today, in a sense, that's what we're seeing in the larger Eastern Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, with a jostling by different ethnic groups, different religious communities, whether it's Jews versus Muslims or Shiites versus Sunnis, Kurds versus Arabs, it's ethnic problems as well. The real identity of these nation states is up in the air, and they're fighting tooth and nail to have one dominant group.
And I guess we're almost out of time, and the question is whether they can, out of all of this, create a national identity to be Syrians, not, you know, some version of a Syrian.
You're absolutely right. And that's the, you know, that's the challenge for the Assad government. And many people think he can't do it after this mm-hmm. bloody war. He says, I'm going to do it. But you do it at the, you know, with a boot on the people's neck. It's unclear.
Yeah.
And the entire region in the Middle East is really trying to find an identity. And we just saw this with a new identity law that was passed in Israel, for example, saying, is it a Jewish state? Is it a state for Israelis? And do the Palestinians included in it? And in Syria, Iraq are going through a very similar problem.
We're going to end on that note. Joshua Landis, as always, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Wonderful to be with you, Marty. I went to Swarthmore in Old Philadelphia, and I've been listening to your show for years. I love it.
Oh, thanks so much. Joshua Landis, Associate Professor, Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the President of the Syrian Studies Association, and he joined us from the studios of the University of Oklahoma. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.